Tonight on Arena, we take a look back at Where Do I Begin? Our series that ran throughout 2020. Without doubt, this year has been most unusual, and here in Arena we took the opportunity to dig a little deeper into well-known writers, filmmakers and songwriters, and every week we ask the question, where do I begin with? And so this evening we look at the life and music of Joni Mitchell, the genre-defining writing of Dashiell Hammett and the work of composer Richard Strauss. But we start with the world of film director David Fincher. Fincher began his career in special effects, then established his name as a music video director before making a splash with generation-defining films like Seven, Fight Club and The Social Network. More recently, he's overseen Netflix hits House of Cards, Mindhunter and Mank. We asked John Maguire to take a look back at the career of David Fincher and how he was lucky enough to grow up next door to another major film director, George Lucas.
He started working in photography and special effects studios when he was still in high school and graduated high school and went straight to work for probably the greatest company name of all time, Industrial Light and Magic, which was owned by Lucas then. And he worked, like you say, on special effects for Return of the Jedi and Indiana Jones and those kind of films. And just at the birth of MTV, Fincher started making music videos. And from there, started working with Propaganda Films, co-founded Propaganda Films, which was just hugely influential. They at one point made a third of all TV ads in the United States, which was, and they had a roster of directors who would go on to Hollywood fame, like Michael Bay, Zack Snyder, Michel Gondry, all these Spike Jones. They were working for Propaganda and making these films. When Fincher got the chance to make a feature, he was handed a poison chalice. Alien 3 was already a disaster by the time he came on board. And it didn't work, and he's disowned the film publicly and loudly ever since. But he had his foot in the door, and it was very quickly afterwards that he made Seven, which was a revelation when it came out in 1997.
What do you think that training, if you like, or that working across music videos in particular and Madonna's Vogue, what did he learn there? Did he carry that aesthetic with him when it came to making features?
Kubrick used to always say that music videos and TV ads were the ultimate films, in that you had to tell a story in 30 seconds and in a music video in 3 minutes. And that's what Fincher learned. And it's fascinating. His background is fascinating because all of the things that we're familiar with, his touchstone touches, if you like, style, visual stylization, pinpoint editing, a visual talent that was formed in that short burst of ads and pop videos. He learned how to frame. He learned how to use the camera. He learned precision. He learned wide shots that are full of detail, that have an economy to them and a purpose to them. And one of Fincher's great innovations, and he's got a career full of innovation, particularly technical innovations, is in matching the camera move to the character movement in the frame, so that as the character moves, the camera moves. So the movement becomes the message, and it introduces an enormous pace to the storytelling. And that's what he managed to do in stretching 3 minutes to 2 hours. And that's a great trick that not all of them learned.
Yeah, and so you, as you mentioned, Alien 3, yes, that was the debut feature, and a bit of a disaster. Seven, however, made €350 million, I think it was, at the
box
office.
And it was an original serial killer story, told with this kind of wet film noir. It rains constantly and it's set in Seattle. And it has the story of a veteran detective and a rookie chasing down a compulsive murderer whose grim work is inspired by the seven biblical deadly sins. But what it did was and Fincher does this throughout his career, it turned Brad Pitt into an actor, which he had not been prior to that, really. He was a pretty boy. He turned him into an actor. And it told a story that was compulsive to watch. It's chaptered into the seven chapters of the deadly sins. It had this great protagonist played by Kevin Spacey. It was a compulsive watch, and like you say, a massive hit. Massive hit.
But you're actually starting us with Fight Club. Is that, do you think that's the kind of, is that the landing point for, or maybe the taking off point Fincher?
I think there's a good argument to be made that Fincher has produced and directed the three defining films of the last three decades. Not necessarily the best films, but the films that defined, that caught the cultural moment. I was going to use the word zeitgeist, but I don't like the word zeitgeist.
And
but
now
that
you've used
culture,
it twice.
That cultural moment, that tension, that anxiety that's out there in the last 30 years, he's managed to capture it three times. Fight Club being the first of them, Zodiac the second, which is his masterpiece, and The Social Network, the story of Facebook, which is extraordinary. Fight Club ties the problem of toxic masculinity and male violence to late-stage capitalism. That's what Chuck Palahniuk's original novel is about.
Let's listen to a clip from Fight Club. Brad Pitt, again, as you said, this is the second time then that Fincher worked with him immediately after Seven. And Pitt is playing the charismatic and dangerous Tyler Durden, and he's greeting new members of Fight Club.
Gentlemen, welcome to Fight Club. The first rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. Third rule of Fight Club, someone yells stop, goes limp, taps out, the fight is over. Fourth rule, only two guys to a fight. Fifth rule, one fight at a time, fellas. Sixth rule, no shirts, no shoes. Seventh rule, fights will go on as long as they have to. And the eighth and final rule, if this is your first night at Fight Club, you have to fight.
Brad Pitt there in a scene from Fight Club, which is the film that John McGuire is getting us to start with when it comes to getting to understand David Fincher. And you mentioned that in the innovations that he had in terms of, you know, the movement of the camera and I suppose the choreography of scenes.
That's right.
Played it directly into this film,
so
John.
So precisely played out. His use of, like you say, fight choreography and the camera movement, but also his seamless and almost invisible use of visual effects, which would become the signature throughout his career. Sometimes it's quite showy and blatant, but most of the time Fincher uses effects work invisibly. It's there to create detail and to build a world. It's not there to show off. But Fight Club is a film with as many champions as it has detractors. It's not a film that I think has aged particularly well. At the time in 1999, yes, it had something to say. But 20 years ago, the idea that men were experiencing this crisis of masculine disenfranchisement and anomie, yes, it was worth exploring. But the urgency of that crisis seems to have faded, if it ever really existed. And it's been superseded by other identity crises. But at the time, he had his thumb right on it. At the time, Fight Club was a massive film.
Zodiac, you refer to as his masterpiece. Newspaper cartoonist Robert Graysmith, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, becomes obsessed with the Zodiac and is involved with Robert Downey Jr.'s journalist. Why is it his masterpiece, would you say?
Well, first of all, there's a five-year gap between Panic Room, which he made in 2002, and Zodiac, which came out in 2007. And he spent those 5 years researching the Zodiac case, who was the serial killer who operated in the 60s and 70s in his hometown of San Francisco. Fincher has a very close personal connection to this in that he was terrified, or so he says, as a child, of the concept of the Zodiac. And to me, it's his masterpiece because it's so beautifully handled and managed. And it's the philosophical notion that the truth is sitting there right in front of you, but you cannot touch it, you can't get close to it. And every time you do put your hand out to grab it, it recedes further away into the distance. And that's really gripping when you're watching a film, when you're watching the story, and every instinct in your body wants conclusions, catharsis. You want things to be answered. You want questions answered. And he can't do that. And he handles that so brilliantly.
And Gyllenhaal plays the cartoonist, as I said, Robert Graysmith, and obsessed, in your words, with tracking down the Zodiac killer. And his colleague, Paul Avery, is played by Robert Downey Jr. And here, I think there's a couple of pints on board, or a couple of drinks on board for this scene, at any rate. They're trying to crack the Zodiac's code.
But who actually cracked the code? A married couple who like puzzles. So what's that tell us about the Zodiac?
He's no expert.
Right, it's just a simple substitution code like the one that we used to do as Boy Scouts. A is one, B is two.
We were no Boy Scouts, Robert.
Well, it's not that hard. You just gotta know where to start, though. In the first cipher.
You actually carry that around with you?
Why?
No reason.
What's the most common double consonant in the English language?
Consonant?
The double L.
Double O.
And what's the one word that we know that he'll use in here at least once?
Kill.
Right, kill. So the Hardens start looking for double symbols, which they find here, here, and here, each with the same two symbols preceding them. So now they've got a repeating four-letter word ending with two symbols that they assume stand for L.
And since I think the whole word is kill.
Then you got the K, you got your I, and you're on your way.
But how do you go from A is one and B is two to figuring out this whole code?
Well, same way I did. You go to the library.
Suddenly you're back there in algebra at school and it becomes a little bit frightening, doesn't it? There, that's from Zodiac, Jake Gyllenhaal and Robert Downey Jr. 2007 film from David Fincher, and the second film that John Maguire is suggesting we might watch if we're trying to decode Fincher. He spent mountains of time shooting and reshooting. He was obsessive in terms of that. You know, is that just obsession or does it pay off? You would say in Zodiac, yes, I'm guessing.
Yes, I think it does. I think Fincher's his perfectionism comes out in the films that he makes. He has this reputation of somebody who has extraordinarily long shoots. He gets 150 days or 170 days when most films would be shot in half that time. He gets a full year for post-production. Again, an extravagance and an indulgence. And as actors will say, he goes 200 takes sometimes, which is incredibly difficult on actors and a very hard thing to do. And to manage a set like that shows the kind of obsessive attention to detail that the director has himself. It's, you know, it's almost natural that it would come out in the work. But if we pass over The Curious Case of Benjamin Button and we come to The Social Network, this was a script by Aaron Sorkin, the West Wing writer, that had been passed around Hollywood for maybe 2 years at this stage.
A lot of talking,
but Fincher glommed onto it straight away because it goes back to this notion that he just has his thumb on exactly where the culture is. And The Social Network is a biopic of a website, really. It's a biopic of Mark Zuckerberg. It's not the most appealing concept, but the way that he draws all the issues that we're currently struggling with, even today, issues around privacy, issues about your personal information, issues about our contact online, those kind of questions are all explored through the character of Mark Zuckerberg, who is not a reliable person, doesn't seem to be a particularly nice person. He's this robotic, almost sociopathic individual.
As portrayed by
Jesse Eisenberg, who's superb in it. But the questions that the film has, again, there's not an awful lot of answers, but there is an extraordinary last section in the film and that last moment that I mentioned earlier where he's sitting alone in a room with a computer. Just the expression of philosophical despair and the times that we live in.
A little bit ahead of the existential moment, there's a straightforward argument about who owns the company
who owns the multi-billion dollar company.
Andrew Garfield playing Eduardo Saverin here, confronting Jesse Eisenberg's Mark Zuckerberg. He's forced him out of the company at this stage. Justin Timberlake as Sean Parker is also in this scene. A bit of strong language within this too.
You signed the papers. You set me up. You're going to blame me because you were the business head of the company and you made a bad business deal with your own company.
This is going to be like I'm not a part of Facebook.
It won't be like you're not a part of Facebook. You're not a part of Facebook.
My name's on the masthead.
You might want to check again.
It's because I froze the account?
You think we were going to let you parade around in your ridiculous suits pretending you were running this company?
Sorry! My Prada's at the cleaners! Along with my hoodie and my fuck you flip-flops, you pretentious douchebag!
Security's here. You'll be leaving now?
I'm not signing those papers.
We will get the signature.
Tell me this isn't about me getting into the Phoenix. You did it. I knew you did it. You planted that story about the chicken.
I didn't plant the story about the chicken. What's he talking about?
You had me accused of animal cruelty.
Seriously, what the hell's the chicken?
And I'll bet what you hated the most is that they identified me as a co-founder of Facebook, which I am. You better lawyer up, asshole, because I'm not coming back for 30%. I'm coming back for everything.
Andrew Garfield, Jesse Eisenberg and Justin Timberlake there from The Social Network. And before that, John Maguire telling us where to begin with David Fincher. Dashiell Hammett, the American writer credited with creating hard-boiled crime fiction, was famous for publishing just 5 novels, including The Maltese Falcon and The Thin Man. In August, Declan Hughes joined us to tell us where to begin with Hammett and how he, in fact, had begun with the film The Maltese Falcon, starring Humphrey Bogart.
As a teenager, Humphrey Bogart was a big hero for me, and I fell in love with his affect, the whole idea of the anti-hero. And then as a bookish teen, I journeyed back in time and I found the books, and it enthralled me that Hammett was the writerly version of Bogart. He was as cool. He was a tall, thin guy. He was a clothes horse. He smoked and he drank. He'd been a soldier. He'd been a Pinkerton detective. He had TB, he published these books that created effectively one of the crucial myths of the 20th century, the anti-hero.
Well, let's listen to Bogart as that anti-hero, Sam Spade, towards the end of the Maltese Falcon, in fact, and he's talking to Bridget here, played by Mary Astor.
Well, if you get a good break, you'll be out of Tehachapi in 20 years and you can come back to me then. I hope they don't hang you, Precious, for that sweet neck.
You're not...
Yes, Angel, I'm going to send you over. The chances are you'll get off with life. That means if you're a good girl, you'll be out in 20 years. I'll be waiting for you. If they hang you, I'll always remember you.
Don't say it. Don't say it, even in fun. Oh, I was frightened for a minute. I really thought you do such wild and unpredictable things.
Now don't be silly. You're taking the fall.
Playing with me. Just pretending you cared to track me like this. You didn't care at all. You don't love me.
I won't play the sap for you.
Oh, you know it's not like that. You can't say that.
You never played square with me for half an hour at a stretch since I've known you.
You know down deep in your heart that in spite of anything I've done, I love you.
I don't care who loves who. I won't play the sap for you. I won't walk in Thursby's and I don't know how many other footsteps. You killed Miles and you're going over for it.
Humphrey Bogart and Mary Astor there in a scene from The Maltese Falcon. And Declan Hughes is with me this evening to answer the question, where do I begin with Dashiell Hammett? He won't play the sap for anybody, Humphrey Bogart. To what extent, you touched on it, Declan, when you were talking about Bogart and Dashiell Hammett. Is Hammett really responsible for creating the career that Humphrey Bogart played that character time and time again in film after film?
Very much so, very much. Up to that point, Bogart had played, you know, the cowardly guy, the second string, who'd almost certainly die before the final reel. And the values of the PI, the man with a code, the existential hero who walked alone, it's Rick Blaine in Casablanca, you know, it's Philip Marlowe, of course, in Hammett's great successor, Raymond Chandler in The Big Sleep. But that gave Bogart a persona, which was hugely influential. And then how many people have been influenced by that? Maltese Falcon was published in 1931, I think, and they'd made two films of it already, neither successful. John Huston came in and he asked his secretary to type up the book, and then they cut it up. Because Hammett wrote in very dramatic fashion. He wrote scenes. He wrote brilliant dialogue. He had an ear for American speech and a high sense of drama. So what you're getting there is the distilled version of the book. And of course, you know, it's a great book. It's a great read. But once you see Bogart, it's impossible to unsee him. In the opening pages, Spade is described as a blonde Satan when he smiles. But we're not thinking blonde. Sam Spade is not blonde.
The other thing about that, I mean, you've touched on this whole world of the PI, of the private detective. A Pinkerton was a term you used. You might explain that a bit further to my innocent ears.
Yeah, well, Pinkerton was the detective agency. And this goes back to people who probably of a certain age familiar with Westerns, where the gunslinger comes into town. And the reason he comes into town is because the sheriff has called him in because he can't handle the fact that there are two rival factions, two ranchers, so the law is disputed. You know, it's before policing has authority. And of course, you know, look to contemporary United States, you might go, tell me that again. But, you know, and so the first novel Hammett wrote, Red Harvest, is with his the fat man before the thin man, the continental op, think Ned Beatty or Bob Hoskins, who goes to this place based on Butte, Montana, called, it's Personville, pronounced Poisonville. And he basically, he's called by the newspaper editor, someone's been murdered, there's murders ensue, and he sets one faction against each other. And then at a certain point, when the killings get out of hand, he confesses to feeling blood simple, which is where the Coens took their title for their first movie. The plot was then reused by Kurosawa for Yojimbo, by Sergio Leone and Fistful of Dollars. You know, it's an archetypal Western plot, but that marked how the Western gunslinger in the plains was becoming the urban PI, with attention being paid to politics and political factions and the kind of gangs that the, each political faction would use to pursue their ends.
And did Hammett have that, that style, you know, the Bogart, the quick-wittedness, the smart remark, you know, the one-of-a-kind phrase? Was that language and that facility there from the writing?
It's interesting, Sean. I mean, I've talked about his attributes. He was the classic, you know, publishers always want an author to have a story. And so he had all these accomplishments as if he just wrote it down onto the page. But he was actually a very ambitious writer and artist. And I mean, think Hemingway, you know, modernism was enabling people after the First World War to do all sorts of things. And one of the things Hammett was doing was taking the kind of artifice out. But the style was very spare, very bone dry wit. He wouldn't have the kind of ornate wit that Chandler, the, those quotable wisecracks, but it's very, very funny on a dry level, you know.
And is the Maltese Falcon? I mean, I know that was the film that sent you to go look up and find out more about Dashiell Hammett as a much younger man. Is the Maltese Falcon in some ways is that the height of his powers, or is it just because I'm associated possibly with the film?
Yeah, I mean, it's the most famous and for some the most treasured. To me, the pinnacle is The Glass Key, the book he wrote after that, which the Coen brothers made use of, to put it mildly, in Miller's Crossing. It's about political corruption in a medium-sized American city, probably Baltimore, which is where Hammett worked as a Pinkerton and he was from Maryland. And it's about male friendship. It's about a love triangle. It's written in this incredibly spare, fluent prose, almost hypnotic, all from the outside. You're inferring people's actions from their gestures, from their movements. But it also has a similar quality to Red Harvest in that there are two political factions and there are their gangs on the streets and their skullduggery. It shares with another novel, a plot in which a father kills a son, and that's as much about Hammett's distrust of authority. He was a lifelong Marxist, but it's an incredibly unusual plot in detective fiction.
And The Thin Man, then, was this his final novel, I think?
The Thin Man, yeah. And it, I mean, just to say, Nick and Nora Charles evokes a certain kind of wisecracking married couple. Lillian Hellman, his partner on and off, said it was maybe the first time anyone had seen a married couple who enjoyed each other's company in a book, you know.
A kind of screwball detective, I think somebody described it as. A screwball detective.
A screwball detective, that's right, yeah. And the film sort of added to that. And he was running with a very sophisticated set at that point, via Hellman to a certain extent, S.J. Perlman, Robert Benchley, Dorothy Parker, you know. So there was a lot of this. It was kind of... he later felt guilty about it. There was a lot of drinking in fancy people's apartments and casual adultery and highly sophisticated and cocktails in the middle of the night. So it's a sort of grown-up's fantasy of Depression era New York, but it's if that's the kind of thing, if you'd prefer to live in a black and white film, as I often would, it's the kind of thing that you can't resist. And it spawned six movies with William Powell and Myrna Loy, of which eventually they became rather saccharine, but the first two are still worth watching.
We skipped over The Maltese Falcon a little bit. What makes it such a classic? Because you were saying for most people it's the classic PI novel.
Yeah, I mean, the characters are so strong, you know? I mean, one of the interesting things about Hammett, I mean, Bridget O'Shaughnessy, he wrote women well. The women in Raymond Chandler looked like he saw them in a magazine and he didn't like them and he was frightened of them, but he knew he had to put them in. Whereas the women in Hammett look like, you know, read like he met a few and more. And he had a very effective way of placing them, not centrally, but you know, of sketching them. But then you have, you know, Joel Cairo, Gutman, you have all those just very rich set of characters. The plot just does not stop. And there's a kind of, you know, mythical undertow. The Maltese Falcon goes back to the kind of Knights Templar of the Crusades. Right. And that's all, you know, the old world is being evoked as the new world is pounding forward. I mean, Hammett was writing in Boomtown, San Francisco initially, that then tipped over into the Depression. And that's where those energies, those street energies came from, but also the energies of ambition, you know, the sense that a new world was forming. And he was, what did he said to his editor at the Black Mask, someday someone is going to make art out of mystery fiction, and I'd like it to be me.
Declan Hughes speaking to us about the crime writer Dashiell Hammett. Join us after the break for Where to Begin with the prolific Joni Mitchell.
Time to whet those appetites with Aldi's delicious nibbles and bites. At only $2.49, there's chicken bites and chicken Kiev bites. Totally tempting tempura prawns, just $2.99. 10 delicious specially selected vegan roses, $3.49. And Costolori Prosecco Frizzante DOC, $7.86. With a glass of Prosecco, something to cheer as you raise a toast to a happy new year. Enjoy an amazing Aldi New Year. Enjoy alcohol responsibly.
At Davy, we know live music has the power to inspire. But at times like this, when the stages are dark and the seat stalls are empty, what can we do to make you feel that power again? We innovate. As innovation partner with the National Concert Hall, we're delighted to support a series of world-class live music events online. Be inspired at home, at work, or wherever you like to listen. For information on concerts, search NCH. Or if you want some world-class financial advice, search Davy. Davy, it's not just business, it's personal. Janie Davy, trading as Davy, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Welcome back to Arena and our Where Do I Begin series, looking at iconic artists and suggesting where we might start with their work. Joni Mitchell is considered one of the great songwriters of the 20th century. As autumn drew in, Rachel Breslin joined us in studio to recommend a starting point with the music of the Canadian artist. In fact, I asked Rachel where she began with the iconic Joni Mitchell.
We're talking about a woman with a career spanning 45 years, over 45 years, and 19 studio albums under her belt. But yeah, like you say, I want the listeners tonight to start with the one that I started with as well. And it's the one that, not necessarily my favourite, but the one that most frequently makes the best of lists.
So you're talking about Blue, you're talking about the album Blue from 1971. So this is kind of in the middle, if you like. What had she achieved just in because we will go back on the earlier stuff, but what had she achieved up to this point, and what was Blue a real turning point in her career?
Blue, I think, yeah, it's regarded as her seminal album. She certainly had lived a life before Blue. I think it was her third album, third or fourth studio album. But yeah, I, as you said, I came to Blue myself as a teenager. I used to babysit for a neighbour of ours. And as soon as the child was asleep every night, I would go through their CD collection, as it was at the time.
Do they know this, that you were rooting through their records?
They know now, Sean. they certainly invited me to do so. And they had Blue, and even better, they had a great sound system in their living room. And that was it. That was all I played every night that I babysat. And that was the start of my lifelong relationship, my love affair with Joni Mitchell. And Blue is an album, I suppose, what stood out for me on Blue, strangely enough, because what Joni Mitchell is really known for is her guitar playing. She's known for a lot of things, obviously, but it's one thing that stands out. And the songs that stood out for me on Blue were unusually the ones that were piano based. So the song Blue itself and the song River, which we all know it starts with that Christmassy little piano part at the beginning. And both of those songs were ones that I could kind of go home and hammer out on the piano. My 15-year-old self, imagining myself to be living Joni these Mitchell. Same things that Joni Mitchell was doing. Yeah.
All right. Okay. And but you've chosen specifically the track A Case of You. Why?
A Case of You, yeah. I guess it encapsulates the honesty and the extreme vulnerability that you can hear on the writing throughout the album. The song is now purportedly about her love affair with Leonard Cohen. That she's never stated that herself, but that's what people take from it. And she talked about the song. She said that she showed it originally to Kris Kristofferson after she first wrote it, A Case of You. And he took one listen to the song, and his response was, "Geez, Joni, keep something for yourself." It was just so raw, so vulnerable. He was almost trying to protect her. She was giving away too much. You're in my blood like holy wine. It tastes so bitter and so sweet. Oh, I could drink a case of you, darling, and I would still be on my feet. Oh, I would still be on my.
That's A Case of You from Joni Mitchell's Blue. Rachel Breslin is with me in studio this evening answering the question, where do I begin with? And in this case, where do I begin with Joni Mitchell? I'm just thinking about the Owl Babysitting. I suppose nice, gentle dulcimer music like we've been hearing there, and that beautiful voice. I mean, her voice is so immediately recognisable. The baby stayed asleep, presumably, during
I don't even know what the baby was doing upstairs. I was so engrossed in this album.
These are things you should not be telling the people you babysat for at the time. The baby's going around singing Joni Mitchell now, as a whatever exactly. He or she would be at this point in their life. You mentioned that the Leonard Cohen aspect of that story and Kris Kristofferson saying, keep something for yourself, Joni. There had been a lot of suffering, never mind just heartbreak, but there had been suffering previously, particularly in her early life. She had a difficult childhood with health issues, didn't she?
Yeah, that's right. She had polio as a child and ended up spending an awful lot of time on her own, which possibly contributed to the poet she later became. It gave her lots of time to be introspective, to watch the world go by and to kind of observe the comings and goings, sitting at home, stuck at home in her house, looking through the window. But she did make a full recovery from that and went on to go to art college. Joni Mitchell has always seen herself as a painter primarily, which might come as a surprise to people who don't know her, because she's so known for being a singer-songwriter and so prolific as that. So in college, she was studying painting, and that was where she started to sing as well, because she was studying with all these other painters, but she felt the need to go that bit further, to do something more innovative again. And she took singing to be that thing. So she took up singing in the evenings, but she kind of had this style where she was mimicking her own heroes like Judy Collins and Joan Baez. And she was very good from the get-go. She had a talent that was recognised straight away. But yes, she did have a more difficult things befell her during her college years. She ended up having a baby very, very young, which was ultimately given up for adoption. She made a really difficult and uncommon and unpopular decision for a woman at that time to give the baby up. And this kind of stayed with her throughout her career. She was troubled about it, and she wrote about the daughter that she gave up many times.
And obviously, as you said, there were albums before Blue in 1971, but did Blue really establish her as an artist and build a relationship with her audience that just hadn't been there previous to that?
Yeah, how she established herself really was by singing in the late 60s in the coffee houses in New York. And that was where people of note began to notice her. Firstly, David Crosby of Crosby, Stills and Nash. And he seemed to kind of open up a whole world of other musicians and so on to her at that time. And that was even before she released her first album, Song to a Seagull, which he actually produced. David Crosby produced it. But she was, I guess her writing was developing all the time at that point, and being exposed to the work of all these other musicians, and indeed hanging out with all these other musicians like James Taylor, Bob Dylan, Neil Young, it changed her writing a lot. Particularly the Bob Dylan, she talked about the way that Bob Dylan wrote as being different to anything she'd heard before.
That lyrical side of things, were they essentially lyric poems? You know, to what extent, I mean, you think of Big Yellow Taxi, which is a kind of an activism type of song, if you like. To what extent was that, the political aspect very present in her lyrics, or were they all very personal lyrics, do you think?
Yeah, the political element became more and more prevalent as she got a little older, as is the case with lots of artists, in fact. But there were themes that were recurrent throughout her whole career. Like, the most revisited theme in all of her albums, I think, is this desire for love and the desire for freedom and the conflict between the two things. Because I suppose, do you find freedom in a love affair, or does a relationship tie you down? And it's something that she grappled with, in this innate dissatisfaction with her own situation through her whole life.
And Hegira was 1976. She went to kind of, and you were saying again, even as we were listening there, you can hear the beginnings of a jazzier style coming in there. She went a bit further down that road subsequent to Hegira in 1976, didn't she?
Yeah, that's right. She ended up making an album with Charles Mingus, who apparently called her from his deathbed to request that she make an album with him. So that one was called Mingus. Very experimental, much more so than what we've heard there. Yeah,
you at the top of your notes, you have a great quote in terms of what she wanted and people listening to her music, what she wanted to give them. Maybe give us that quote. Oh, sorry, it's here. Well, that you don't. I thought you had it in front of you. I'll read it out then, but it's you that passed it on to us. The trick is, if you listen to the music and you see me, you're not getting anything out of it. If you listen and see yourself, it'll make you cry and you learn something about yourself, and now you're getting something from it. There's a kind of an altruism, a lack of ego in that, that's extraordinary in many ways.
A lack of ego, but in other ways, she didn't care really what people, I feel that she didn't care what people thought about her. People, and you can even see it now with online discussion forums and so on, people's relationship with Joni Mitchell goes, I think, one of two ways. It's people who want to be her and people who want to be her friend. But loads of people feel like she's just looking into their soul and she knows them better than they know themselves.
It's impossible to talk about Joni Mitchell without playing the song we're going to finish up with, which is Both Sides Now. And this is a version from 2000, so it's very different from maybe from earlier versions that you might have heard. How does this typify her work, do you think? Because this is where you're sending us to as a third possible listen.
Well, what's really incredible about this song, more than anything else, is it's very reflective. The lyrics are reflective, but it's kind of the song that bookended her career, because she sang it as a naive, sort of wiser than her years, 23-year-old. And then she recorded another orchestrated version, as you said, in 2000. And the significance of listening to a much older woman looking back on her life, she really has looked at life from both sides now.
I've looked at clouds from sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's cloud illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds.
And that was Rachel Breslin advising us where to begin with Joni Mitchell, and for the season that's in it, how appropriate to finish on the track Both Sides Now, which features in Richard Curtis's Christmas-themed film, Love Actually. After the break, Fergus Shiel tells us where to begin with the music of Richard Strauss. And welcome back to tonight's Arena. Richard Strauss has been described as a successor to Wagner and Liszt. Artistic Director of Irish National Opera Fergus Shiel joined us to discuss the work of the composer. Born in Munich in 1864, Strauss, along with fellow composer Gustav Mahler, is considered to represent a late flowering of German Romanticism. I began by asking Fergus Shiel about a special memory he had of the first time he heard Richard Strauss's work.
When I was in college in Trinity studying music, I remember a lecturer put on a recording of the second of the four last songs, which were written in 1948, just right at the end of Strauss's life. And I remember just being totally mesmerised and perplexed by it, because it was so complex and so luscious and so voluptuous. It was like you were immersed in a chocolate factory or something. It was so beautiful, and almost like I couldn't believe that music could be that beautiful. You know, when you have one of those experiences that redefines for you exactly what the possibilities are. And that beautiful recording with Jesse Norman singing so beautifully, it really transfigured me. And I've loved Strauss's music ever since.
And in fact, it's the second, as you say, of the four last songs that we're going to hear this evening. Spring is the first, When Falling Asleep is the third, and At Sunset is the fourth. September is the one that you've chosen. I guess even that title, the fact that we're in September, gives us a kind of an autumnal feel to what Strauss was at here.
Exactly. And this is it was from the very end of his life, as I said. And obviously the imminence of death is something that is just over his shoulder, as it were, and it rears its head in many of the songs. But he's quite at peace with it. What you have in this is you have a lifetime of experience. It's like he's packed everything that he's ever learned throughout his entire life into it. And I would urge, if your listeners, if we're going to play a little bit, turn up the volume, listen really carefully to like everything that's happening. It's like a whole dense forest of activity that's happening under that beautiful voice.
Voice of Jesse Norman there with the Gewandhaus Orchestra of Leipzig, conducted by Kurt Mazur, and the second of the four last songs of Richard Strauss. Fergus Scheel choosing some pieces from Strauss for us to start with to whet our appetites to listen to more. He really, Strauss really knows how to orchestrate the music, doesn't he? Like, there's so much happening there.
Yeah, it's pure chocolate or velvet or something. It's so rich and beautiful.
Lockdown, then, that particular recording, in fact, I think, as you said, as you told us, was very much your starting point with Richard Strauss. Lockdown sent you back to the composer.
Well, yes, what I realised was that I only know a small fraction of his music very well. And, he's a major figure, particularly of opera. And I work in opera, as you mentioned. Mm. And it occurred to me that, you know, I've really only come across one or two of his operas. I've only worked on one myself personally. And I've seen them internationally. But in Ireland, you don't come across them so much. And I'm thinking about what we want to do and how we could maybe program some of his operas in the future. But I decided it was time for me to learn a little bit more. So I did something I've never done before. So I put all of his music, every single piece he wrote, onto a Spotify playlist. And I started at the beginning and went through it over months and months and months. And I listened to it. I was walking every day and listened to it on my noise-cancelling headphones and immersed myself in an hour or an hour and a half of his music every day, and went right from the beginning to the end. It took about 6 months to do it.
But that's it. So you actually started at Opus One and worked your way through the entire body of work. That must have given you an incredible overview of how the music develops.
Yeah, and you know, he was a composer for 80 years. He began writing music when he was 6, and he wrote his last piece when he was 85 or 84. So, you know, it's an enormous body of work, and you can hear it developing and growing over the years, and you can hear how he goes in and out of particular phases where he's only writing opera, or phases where he's writing more orchestral music. And right at the end of his life, when he wrote quite a number of orchestral pieces, you get a feeling for all that. But I think the one thing that really struck me most of all is the voice. It's a human voice. Yeah. You know, he's written lots of orchestral material, but it's just the operas, it's the beauty of the voice, it's his leader. He's written so many songs as well, and many of the songs he wrote for piano and he subsequently orchestrated as well, so they exist in a number of versions. And they're just the most spectacular music, and his particular love of the voice, particularly the female voice.
Well, let's go to, you mentioned one that he wrote maybe for piano and voice, and then subsequently orchestrated, the version we have of Morgan or Morning, featuring Elisabeth Schwarzkopf. What particularly struck you about this recording, Fergus?
Well, of course, Schwarzkopf is an absolutely top Strauss singer. I think the song itself is just so beautiful, because you'll hear on this now, it begins with a solo violin it sounds almost like a violin concerto to begin. And then after a moment or so, the voice comes in almost subservient to the violin at first and then takes over. And the text begins with the word "and." It's "and tomorrow the sun will shine again." It's like the singer comes in the middle of a sentence, and it's this beauty and the love of the two people at the centre of this song. And there's also that kind of tinge of maybe something has gone wrong and they're having a reconciliation, and that they've decided to give their relationship one more go. At least that's how I read the text. That might be my own view of it, but it's this beauty and the morning and the sea and the couple on the beach looking at the blue sky, and the beauty of the orchestration is incredible.
So incredibly beautiful, Morgan, the Richard Strauss song, their Morning, sung by Elisabeth Schwarzkopf, and it was the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra there, conducted by Georges Sell. Fergus Scheel choosing the music for us this evening for Where Do I Begin With? I mean, he's asking us or advising us on where to begin with Richard Strauss. You mentioned Schwarzkopf before we listened to that, Fergus, as having the perfect Strauss voice. What is the perfect Strauss voice?
Well, I think with Strauss, it's very much it's about clarity. It's about diction and the text, and using the text to help shape the music. And also, I think she had a large enough voice because some of his orchestration is huge. So in that song, you can hear she's not particularly, she doesn't have to sing terribly loud, but she can when she needs to, and she can, she has the personality and the voice to adapt to larger contexts. His operas, I mean, the reason his operas are not performed so much here in particular is they are absolutely enormous. If you take something like the Rosenkavalier, for example, there's 26 singing roles in it and 7 silent roles and a chorus as well, and orchestra and offstage orchestra. It's just enormous. Yeah. And it's like the world, it's capturing all the emotions of the world, and so it's quite a prospect.
Yeah, so you said that maybe in terms of Irish National Opera, you'd be thinking about working towards a Strauss opera. Would it be Der Rosenkavalier? Yes. Yeah,
that's very high on the wish list, absolutely, and partly because Strauss had this absolute affinity for female voices, and there's something in the water in Ireland that we have so many fantastic female singers, so I can think of lots of people who would do wonderful performances of the three. There's three very major female roles in the Rosenkavalier, so it's very much on the cards. Hopefully it won't take too long to bring it about.
Fergus Shiel there on the life and works of composer Richard Strauss. Join us tomorrow evening on Arena, where we'll take a look back at some of our big name interviews from film and TV this year, including Neil Jordan and Werner Herzog.